support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. We're getting a preview of the upcoming Rewilding Conference set for January 23rd in Portland.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The ninth year of the annual North American Rewilding Conference is returning to Portland January 23rd through 25th. The weekend-long event will be a place for people to discuss cultural rewilding, conservation of natural spaces, ecological crisis, along with many other topics. I spoke with Peter Michael Bauer, the Executive Director of Rewild Portland, about the conference. All right. Would you mind introducing yourself?
My name's Peter Michael Bauer. I'm the Executive Director of Rewild Portland.
So how would you define wild and rewild?
Yeah, it's a good question. It takes me usually like 10 hours to like explain this to people. I have a class called Rewilding 101 that kind of like dives into that. But, you know, elevator pitch, you know, wildness, oftentimes people think of wildness like wilderness, and they have this misconception that wilderness means untrammeled by man, which is like one of the older sort of conceptions of it, you know. Oftentimes because you had like early conservationists here that were coming across landscapes that were super diverse, very abundant in wildlife, and they basically thought that these were humanless landscapes. And so for early on in conservation to protect wild spaces, they perceived wildness as places that didn't include humans. And so to, you know, conservation rewilding, which is another form of rewilding, basically came out of this idea of removing people from a landscape in order to rewild it or have it return to a wilderness, which meant unmanaged by people. What we do with rewilding is called cultural rewilding, which differentiates from conservation in many ways, although both of them did emerge from Earth First activism in the 1980s. So back then you had, you know, conservation was actually sort of more conservative than liberal, or sort of a combination of both. And in the 80s, a lot of these conservations, similar to like how the like Fish and Wildlife, you know, protected areas were created by hunters, like conservative hunters. A lot of conservative people in rural areas in the 80s were seeing a lot of the environment being destroyed and wanted to protect it. And so Earth First was actually kind of created by this collective of different people with different perceptions. At some point in that time, you had this, you know, differentiation or diversification of the idea of rewilding. And it became more conservation focused on one side and more cultural focused on the other side. They both came out of the same community. But to me, wildness doesn't remove humans. In fact, wild environments, or what is in anthropology called anthropogenic environments, those that are modified by humans, are still quote unquote wild. So if we look at the etymology of the word wild, you know, it actually comes from just the Germanic Wald, which means forest. But, you know, sort of the folk etymology is that it comes from the idea of being willed, or like having a free will. So wild meaning willed, although again, it's not really the actual etymology of it. But if you think about like what is the opposing force of wildness, is domestication or captivity. And what is broken when you break a horse? You break their will to escape. You break their will to move, to motivate. And so to me, wildness means to have will, to be willed, and to not exist within captivity, or to be against and break free from captivity. So when we look at cultural rewilding, what we're looking at is this idea that humans have been domesticated or held in captivity, and we're trying to work our way back towards a more wild and free existence. And so it's very much aligned with, you know, anarchist principles in terms of freedoms and freedom of association and things like that. It doesn't necessarily, you know, I think a lot of people obviously have misconceptions of anarchy, which is very intentional on the state. to make it sound like it's chaos, right? Like pure chaos, wild. So that's kind of one of the things I talk about in my class is, you know, we have this concept of wildness that we both romanticize and demonize simultaneously within our culture, where, you know, we demonize it and say wild and crazy, and then we romanticize it and say wild and free. So which is it, right? Which is it going to be? And you can't like see both at the same time. And the reason why it's wild and crazy is because what they're meaning is, you know, something that is wild is resistant to captivity. And so that appears within a hierarchical society as ours as crazy. And so there's definitely like a lot of projections into the word that, you know, require some decolonizing or decompression or redefining in some ways. So yeah, it's a loaded question.
Yeah,
but yeah, I mean, and it's a good question too, because it does come, you know, when we have something called like the Rewilding Conference, some people might think that it's based in conservation biology rewilding, which we don't shun away from that either. That's a great, you know, conservation is super important and preservation of wildlands is really important. It's just that there's a lot more we can be doing. There's a lot more kinds of interaction that we can be having with the landscape. You know, I think years and years ago when I sort of first learned of rewilding and came across it and learned of this sort of dichotomy or the difference between conservation rewilding and cultural rewilding, I was at that time reading the book Tending the Wild, which had just came out. So this is probably like 2006 by M. Cat Anderson. And it's basically about how indigenous people manage their landscapes for abundance and the resources that they needed to exist and in particular places. And I'm using past tense because the book was about, you know, pre-colonial land tending practices that, of course, are still being implemented today where their state allows it or where they're on the fringes and can get away with it or even where the state is like promoting it. So like in California, there are like state-sponsored fire regimes. And so they call it traditional ecological knowledge, where it's this knowledge of how to tend the wild spaces in a way that is, you know, sustainable. And so I was like, well, that's an interesting part of conservation that's kind of emerging. And I bet there's going to be at some point like a marriage between or reconvening between these two different styles of rewilding. And I've seen it happen more and more lately, you know. And that's a really good thing because we do need more wild spaces, and but they also need to be tended by people. And there's a lot of First Nations and Indigenous people all around the world that have that knowledge still or are reseeking it. And of course, they oftentimes it's called decolonization in their work. But I think rewilding and decolonizing in terms of cultural rewilding are also very similar.
What is the what does this conference aim to accomplish? Like what is the message that is trying to be conveyed to people?
Yeah, so we have had multiple themes. So this is the ninth year of the conference, which is kind of mind-blowing to me. We had different themes initially the first few years, and then it kind of became really clear that we wanted to focus on, at least as a theme, subsistence. So, you know, sometimes when people say subsistence, they think it's like they were barely subsisting, like just enough to exist or whatever. I'm using it more in an anthropological sense or just like a culture, like what do you do to make your living to, you know, get the food that you need and things like that. And so, you know, the whole economy, our existence is based on what we're consuming and how we're consuming it. And so to kind of think about that as the lens through which cultural rewilding sees the world, as opposed to something like conservation rewilding, which may be like, you know, restoring a thing to like 200 years ago or something. And it may not be really, it might just be like an assemblage of plants and animals in a particular place, but for no apparent reason other than this is what was here 200 years ago, right? Whereas like if you put humans in the picture, why were those things there 200 years ago? You know, and this is again why I think cultural rewilding and conservation rewilding have this bridge with traditional ecological knowledge, because indigenous people are constantly managing their landscapes for the things that they need to subsist. And this is what humans have done since time immemorial. So to kind of emphasize the subsistence component of rewilding at the conference was something that we felt we needed to do, especially because, like, you know, if you were to like Google the word rewilding from like 2004 until like 2014, it was all cultural rewilding stuff. And then George Monbiot out of England wrote a book called Feral, and conservation rewilding blew up. And so for the last 10 years, conservation rewilding is the main thing. So if you say rewilding down the street, you know, most people, especially in European countries or whatever, they're going to think you're talking about something else, right? And so one of the reasons why we decided to focus on this with the conference was really to kind of emphasize what cultural rewilding is about and then how we can sort of bring in conservation rewilding, but as subsistence, sort of as the central component. So like, yeah, we're not just restoring a landscape to its particular, you know, to some random thing for no apparent reason other than that this is what it was before, but that we're looking at the usage of how people, you know, get things from the environment, right? What do we need from the environment? How do we subsist from it? And so that's kind of like the framework of our conference. However, we do have all kinds of other random things that kind of have less to do directly with subsistence. It's actually one of my jobs with the conference this year, they told me, is I actually have to come up with a way of describing how all of the different speakers that we have are threaded together through this theme. And so that's why, you know, I think the word cultural to preface the word rewilding makes sense there. Because then if it's cultural, all, like what isn't cultural really? You know what I mean? There's all kinds of stuff. But then how do we root it back into the land through like this lens of subsistence? And I guess that's what I have to write up next week. While I also write my talk, because I'm going to be doing a different talk this year. So, let's move on to your next question. I hope that answered something.
No, I think that was great.
Cool.
I could answer probably a couple questions.
Yeah.
So I was reading about the conference, mm-hmm. and there was about an open space, mm-hmm. and I was curious to know more about that. What does that like entail?
Yeah. So the conference is broken into three parts. We have speakers on Friday, an open space conference on Saturday, and then field tending projects on Sunday morning, and then a keynote on Sunday afternoon. Open space to me is like the best part of this conference. If you've never done an open space conference before, I highly recommend like searching it, looking it up. I knew a bunch of people who worked in the software world, and they did open space as part of like software conferences, software design, or like programmers would come together and do what's called an open space. Open space technology, I think, is like the trademark term. And it's a way of running a conference where there are no speakers that are like elevated above others. All of the content, all of the conversations are generated by participants first thing. And the agenda is built first thing. So if you are somebody who is inspired about a topic, you can't find anybody to talk with you about it, but you know, oh, I bet the Rewilding Conference will have somebody who's going to want to talk about X, Y, Z, whatever it is. I'm going to go there and hold space for it. I might not know anything about it myself, but that's okay. I'm just going to hold space for it. Or you're like, I want to learn about a thing, or I have something to say, right? Like I have an idea I want to share with other people. And I want to hold space for that. So open space works really well when there's like a theme or a central question that people are asking, because then a whole community can come together, assemble, and essentially organically generate conversations around this topic, around like not necessarily solutions, but you get cross-pollination, you get all kinds of stuff. So essentially, you know, you have what's called we call it the wall of confluence, and it's our agenda. Down one side is time, it's time slots. Across the top is locations, and you're all in one giant room. And so say I want to have a conversation about how do we bring back more Chinook Wawa, which is the heritage language of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde. Like, how can we introduce that more to like public consciousness? I'm going to have a conversation about that. And maybe there's a member of the tribe there who wants to join in on it. I've been learning Chinook Wawa at the tribal office for like 15 years at this point. So I'm in that community. I'm always looking for ways of elevating more local indigenous language into the conversation. So as a non-native person, as a settler descendant, like how can I do that in a respectful way? Like maybe that's part of my conversation too, right? So I write about it. I tell people, hey, this is what I'm going to do. I put it up on the wall of confluence where and when, and then I'm just there during that time. If no one shows up, no one shows up. If people show up, that's great. usually there's, you know, all of the conversations are very filled with different people. And you just get this really amazing organic experience. I feel like it's something that is hard to pitch to people. Which is what happened in the original first 2 years of the conference. We just did open space, and people had a hard time kind of like grasping what the themes of things to talk about would be. And so that's why we sort of split the conference into these sort of separate days, where the first day are selected speakers. So we will select speakers that we want to come, whose voices we want to elevate, to talk about something related to rewilding, to kind of get people's, the juices flowing, so to speak, in the brain of like what might be good conversations for the next day. And then the open space, aside from just being a cool place to like chat with other people about all kinds of very interesting things, you're also just networking, you're socially connecting, you're making friends, you know. Last year was very interesting because it was like right after, someone took off political office. Don't want to say their name. And so everybody was just feeling this like horrible sense of doom. And to be able to come together right after that and be with like-minded people who are all working to restore the degraded landscapes as well as culture, was really powerful for a lot of people. You know, feeling that sense of belonging to a group that had a higher purpose, that was working together to stop the problems that we're facing or address the like polycrises of climate change and ocean acidification and ecological die-off and all the things that we're facing in the next 100 years, you know?
Yeah.
So open space is just a really beautiful way of meeting other people where they're at, decentralizing authoritarian or authority in terms of knowledge keepers, where somebody who might be one of the speakers, for example, who were elevating on Friday might just be walking around joining other people's conversations on Saturday, just like a normal person would, right? Like we're not elevating them beyond the scope of just wanting what they have to say be something that we tell everybody. And then of course, Sunday, I did mention Sunday briefly. Sunday is the land tending part of the conference where we'll go out and actually do some land tending. The first day, lots of information coming in. The second day, social networks, connecting with other people, very heady. So we realized we needed to get people like rooted back into the ground and actually do land tending. So we kind of end the conference on Sunday there and then come back together for the final keynote experience of it.
That was KBOO News in Depth with Peter Michael Bauer, Executive Director of Rewild Portland. For registration for the North American Rewilding Conference, go to rewilding.com. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Lizard.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. As outrage grows over the fatal shooting of a Minneapolis woman by an Immigration and Customs Enforcement officer, civil rights attorney Mark Reichel is speaking out and warning that the killing raises serious constitutional concerns about ICE authority and the use of deadly force. Reichel is a founding member of the ACLU Sacramento chapter and an attorney with more than 3 decades of experience in constitutional and civil rights law. He says video evidence shows the woman was acting within her legal rights and posed no lawful justification for lethal force. He spoke with KPFA's Lauren Schmidt.
Mark, thank you for joining us on KPFA News. As a civil rights attorney, you've been outspoken after watching video of the killing of Renee Good in Minnesota. You noted that Good was likely within her legal rights and noted that ICE generally cannot arrest a U.S. citizen unless there is probable cause that that person is harboring an undocumented individual. You've also stated that even regular police would not be justified in using deadly force against someone who is fleeing. From a legal standpoint, can you walk us through what happened and why you believe the shooting was unlawful?
Their written policy disallows them from firing their weapon at a vehicle that's exiting. Number two, their written policy and their training also requires them to take the facts and circumstances of each incident into the equation. This officer that did the firing had a cell phone in his hand and he was circling her vehicle, taking a video of her. He then steps to the, he's in front of her vehicle, getting his gun out. He then steps to the side. He's definitely to the side. The angle of the shot shows where it came from, and you can't change that. So the angle through the windshield comes from the left of the windshield. If you're looking out the windshield, to the left. If you're looking at the windshield, it comes to the right. And the angle shows where he fired from. Not only that, the video shows where he fired from. He's not in front of her vehicle. He's to the left of her vehicle. Her wheels are turned to the right. He's turning to the right and moving away from him. And he stands back against his policy and fires the three shots. There's just no two ways about it, that it was illegal, that it violates their own policy. It violates the law in the state of Minnesota anyway. And it's an unjustified shooting that results in the death. That is a definition of murder.
We've seen a troubling pattern in ICE-involved shootings where initial federal claims are later contradicted by video, like in Chicago and in Los Angeles, where charges were just dropped after video contradicted agents' accounts, including evidence that an ICE officer accidentally discharged his weapon, striking an individual. Can you talk about this pattern and whether ICE is operating with impunity? And if so, how?
This will happen tomorrow. This probably happened a month ago. It will continue to happen under the Trump administration. There's just no dispute. There really is no longer the rule of law in America. And I don't say that casually. There's a hole in the Constitution that really has been exposed by MAGA. Specifically, the executive branch has all the power because they have all the guns, basically. It's actually that simple. So when they got together for the Constitutional Convention in 1788, they locked themselves in, you know, for a year in Philadelphia. There was all sorts of fights, you know, they had fist fights and so forth, and they did everything. But at the end of the day, they had to finish. They had to come up with a document. And what was left was what to do about the possibility of a despotic executive branch. Because when it comes down to it, not everything can be decided by the courts. Not everything can be done by Congress. You have to have some trust. You know, you have to have some type of trust in an executive branch to administer things. And they gave the executive branch basically all the power because they truly believed Americans would never want a monarchy again, because the sacrifice to create the country in 1776 was immense. It was like something you hard to imagine, actually, brother versus brother and so forth. And they're giving up everything to do this. And they really did believe for the first time really in, you know, history of civilization that, you know, never a monarchy again, I mean, at all. And so they didn't think that Americans would countenance a despot or a monarch. But what they didn't realize that the country would get so big, you know, from the original 13 colonies, that it would get so big and stretch across the country like this, that, you know, it could get to the point where about 40% of the people do want a monarchy. They do want to be led. Freedom means responsibility, and that's why a lot of people dread it. And so what's happened here is, at some point, if all the smartest minds on earth got together and wanted to create a constitution to govern a country, you are going to be left with a difficult check and balance on the executive branch when they're the only ones that have, you know, a standing army or control the military. And you know, I'll just tell you my firm belief, like what Mao one time said prophetically in the 40s, was that all power stems from the barrel of a gun. And what he's really saying is there are no, you know, there's no real morality. There's no, you know, principles. It's all about facts. And it's about, you know, power is facts. And those who have the guns really have the power. What can this, if the Supreme Court right now said Trump is illegal and, you know, he can no longer operate. I mean, Stephen Miller, they're very clear. MAGA is very clear. That's irrelevant to them. So, you know, everybody says, oh, when the Democrats take over the House and if the Democrats take over the Senate, that's irrelevant to MAGA. What can the House do? They don't have an army. I mean, they can say, oh, they'll cut off the budget. Trump would just order the marshals to go to the bank and at gunpoint order the bankers to wire the money to the federal government, you know? So my point is there's a huge hole in our Constitution that the MAGA group under Trump has identified.
And finally, the head of Minnesota's state investigations agency says the U.S. Attorney's Office has barred it from participating in the investigation into the fatal shooting of Minneapolis resident Renee Good by an ICE officer, leaving the case solely in the hands of the FBI under Trump loyalist Kash Patel. Given that, what should the public realistically expect from this investigation?
He will not be charged. They've spirited him out of Minnesota, even if the state of Minnesota charges him, it would be up to the feds to surrender him, and they would never do that. And if they were required, if they felt that they had to, they would remove the case to federal court under 28 USC 1442 and make it a federal case, and they would then dismiss the charges because then the federal government is in charge of the prosecution. If you think otherwise, good Lord, are you not paying attention to what's going on? So they understand that they have all the power. They understand it's unchecked, and they understand that factually, short of an armed revolution, it cannot be checked. Congress can't do anything. The Supreme Court can't do anything. And so they know they can do whatever they want. They say that every day.
Civil rights attorney Mark Reichel spoke with KPFA's Lauren Schmidt. You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. Portland City Council's Transportation and Infrastructure Committee met this morning, January 12th, for the first time this year. Funding crunches were a topic for the committee, considering resolutions on how to support transportation and infrastructure projects that have lost much state and federal funding. Councilor Mitch Green floated using the Portland Clean Energy Fund, or PCEF, to support TriMet through an intergovernmental agreement, or IGA.
I want to kind of bring out into the public some of the conversations I've had privately, or just, you know, whisperings in the hall around potentially approaching the climate investment plan amendment process with a lens towards using some PCEF revenue to support TriMet through some sort of an IGA. And I want the experts who know a lot about that to be able to talk to this committee, because in my view, the biggest threat to our climate goals is backsliding and losing ground on ridership, which is a potential doom loop, if you will, for transit. Once people switch away from riding a bus and they decide to get that car, they're never going to go back to riding a bus. Or if they do, it'll take pretty Herculean effort to do so. And so that then feeds on itself in a doom loop sort of situation. And so I know that our Chief Sustainability Officer, Vivian Satterfield, has some expertise and some thoughts on that, and maybe some of the limits there. I know that my colleagues in the climate committee have also probably talked about this too. And so that's an integrated piece that I hope that we can look at together.
That's excellent. I really appreciate that. I appreciate your candor as well. And I also feel abandoned by the federal and state government, and that we're kind of on our own here, going to have to help ourselves or raise our own revenue. I like your idea about the TriMet as well, and maybe we can discuss that at our next meeting also. And clearly, transportation, I think, is the biggest contributor to the climate impact as well. So that's really important. Councilor Rio.
I was just going to let folks know, since the discussion has been brought up at this week's climate committee on Thursday, we're going to be discussing different options for about $15 million of PCEF dollars that are available, whether or not we should keep using them for housing infrastructure and making that more climate friendly, or, you know, things like what if we invested it on the bus? This is an open discussion. No decisions are being made, so no one should feel alarmed. It's just a discussion that is being had. And I think the TriMet question is definitely one. I believe Vivian is going to bring folks to talk to us about, you know, TriMet Youth Pass and things like that. Although we really do need to look at the numbers, because it could be quite a sizable chunk if we don't do it carefully. And we want to make sure that while we are balancing, as a transit user that desperately needs some of the bus lines that are getting cut, we need to balance the need to protect PCEF and its integrity and what it was meant for, and also look at some of these emerging issues, given that the federal and state legislature did abandon us on public transit issues. As a transit rider, I told my team they'll probably never see me on time again. So, hopefully we can get that figured out somehow.
You just heard an excerpt from this morning's Portland City Council Transportation and Infrastructure Committee meeting. As referenced in the clip, the Climate, Resilience, and Land Use Committee will meet this Thursday at 9:30 a.m. in Council Chamber. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billing.
is no sense in housing. And I would like to stress that. There is no sense in housing. And I would like to stress that.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO's zine, The Boo Beat, is back with a second issue, featuring KBOO's program guide, interviews with local activists and community members, spotlights on local